Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you feeling?
I'm doing all right. Been a little sick this week, but finally.
It's the season, right?
Yeah, something's going around. Took a bunch of COVID tests. It wasn't that, but it wasn't good either. Anything new in the news today?
I don't know what's gotten into me, Justin, but I've gotten back into following trials day by day.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ones that I'm following is the Texas versus Juan David Ortiz. Have you heard of this?
No, I have not.
It's been described as the Border Patrol serial killer trial. Juan David Ortiz, who was a U.S. Border Patrol agent, and he was accused of four murders.
Mm-hmm.
So this trial has been all about the state using its many weapons in this case, which is all the evidence against this guy. I'd say the key was that he used his own service pistol, a 40 caliber pistol, to murder these women.
Uh-huh.
But beyond that, he even told authorities where they could find one of his victims, and they hadn't even known about her.
At this point, there's no question. He's not fighting the conviction per se. He's trying to get leniency by cooperating.
Well, that's where it's kind of weird, because his attorneys didn't really do much until their closing arguments. His attorney really focused on how the authorities dealt with him, which is how they deal with everyone, right? They put you in a room, they talk to you here and there, and they kind of keep in there for a good while. In this case, they kept him in there like 10 hours. And over that time, they tried to get him to open up. That's where they said there's a problem, because they said the authorities didn't really have probable cause to search his vehicle. And which I know you'll laugh at. And then they also said they didn't like how he was treated when he was being interrogated. They feel like he had essentially said he would not cooperate, and yet they kept pressing. But this is what law enforcement does. They have someone who they feel strongly has committed crimes, and they need to get to the bottom of it to protect the public. I bring this up because he was found guilty today, which we're recording this update on December 7th. This is not the surprise. The surprise for me was when his defense attorney was speaking in the closing arguments, he was careful of his wording. but it really seemed like he was trying to ask the jury to toss this case because freedom was on the line here. They shouldn't have been able to question him like this. They shouldn't have been able to search his vehicle the way they did. And so for any of you wondering what this case is about, I urge you to go read up on it. I mean, when there was a woman who had been in his vehicle with him, as soon as she started bringing up that some of her friends had disappeared, he put a gun to her. And so she ran off, she got away, and she told law enforcement. All I can tell you is there didn't seem to be any way for him to not be found guilty in this trial, given all the evidence they had against him. But it seemed like his attorneys were trying to pull a move that you've talked about in the past, jury nullification.
If there was some sort of precedent that was going to be set here, then yeah, we need to analyze this case. It was kind of like the Barry Jones case. You can't argue from emotion. You have to argue from what is justice, what is righteous, what is legal, and what are our rights. But no one's going to have any sympathy for a guy like this who was probably using his position of authority to manipulate people, and he is a serial killer. So no one cares if his rights were violated. In this case, it probably doesn't mean that because they landed this way on this case, it's going to affect other people. But if they let him walk, would anyone let a serial killer walk? No, that's not going to happen.
Well, I can tell you is, Justin, I feel like they had probable cause. The attorney, the prosecutor, did a great job of pointing that out by saying Juan Ortiz ran after being questioned about his involvement in threatening a woman and possible murders. He just took off. This is a U.S. Border Patrol agent. He's only running because of one thing. I think they had good reason to search his vehicle.
In a vacuum chamber, we could say running or fleeing doesn't exactly state you're guilty, but being what he is and his position, there's no reason for him to try to elude authorities. There's no reason for him to flee as compared to someone on the street just minding their own business. And then police roll up on him and they're like, I don't want to deal with this. And they just take off. That doesn't give you any probable cause. But if you are a law enforcement officer and you run away from other law enforcement officers, that's enough for them. And I'm not trying to side with the government here, but I know in the state of Kansas, they had a big sign that went across the highway that said drug interdiction checkpoint ahead, but there wasn't one. But when somebody saw that sign, they would immediately exit the highway thinking that everyone on the highway was getting pulled over. But where the drug interdiction checkpoint was, it was at the end of the exit, and they used anyone exiting the highway. Well, that's probable cause to search your vehicle because you were trying to avoid a make-believe drug interdiction checkpoint. I mean, it's crazy what the government does, but they get away with it every day.
Oh, and one final note. Happy 21st birthday to Emma Fielding.
Tonight's case, Aaron, takes place on a boat. I feel like this case is, maybe it's just because of the boat, but it reminds me a little bit of the Scott Watson case. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of people that think they saw a person fleeing the scene, think they saw somebody that might have been involved. But at the end of the day, it's really hard to sort out. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the 1982 Investor murders that, like you said, took place on a boat, a rather large boat.
The boat was named The Investor. It was 58 feet long and was more or less a fishing boat, although it had living quarters and all kinds of stuff on it. It was very nice. It was, you know, when I saw a picture of it, I didn't go, oh, that's a fishing boat. I was thinking, that's a nice boat. But then when you see the back end of it and everything, you're like, okay, that's a more utility-ish looking boat now.
Let's clear it up by talking about what it's worth. I mean, at the time, it was worth about $850,000.
Close to a mil.
That's some serious money back in 1982.
Yeah.
The owner of the boat was Mark Colthurst. And ever since he was a teenager, he was very much into fishing. His dream was to be the captain of his own boat. The fact that he eventually bought this 58-foot fishing boat called the Investor. Well, that was him making it. That was him achieving his dream. But of course, people that are driven, Justin, sometimes they have a reputation, right?
Well, and he's only 28 years old achieving these dreams. You're probably going through life fighting tooth and nail to get to where you're at to be that successful.
So he wasn't just successful financially, but he was successful family-wise. They said he was very devoted to his family. He had a 28-year-old wife named Irene, and then they had a couple of kids, a girl named Kimberly, who was 5, and a boy named John, who was 4. Like you said, they can live on this boat, and so they do that. They also have some crew members who help out with the fishing. Chris Heyman, who was 18, Jerome Keown, who was 19, Dean Moon, 19, and of course, Mike Stewart, 19, like the others. In 1982, they had been fishing and they pulled in a pretty good amount. I guess it was worth over $30,000 worth of fish, but there were some days on the calendar wiped out where they couldn't turn them in. So they would have to hold on to their catch for a day or two. But of course, the day we're talking about, Justin, is also Mark's birthday. So the family was celebrating.
It's September 5th, 1982, and it's his 28th birthday.
So they went to a local restaurant to celebrate, and then later that evening, they headed back to the boat.
And this is going on in Craig, Alaska, which is not a very big town. A lot of people know each other in this town. It's not as if you could live in this town or work in this town and not be at least 1 or 2 degrees from other people, other locals.
Well, especially with this fishing community.
So they're out, they're celebrating at his favorite restaurant. And then it's September 6th that things are not as they seem.
Right. Let me talk about a witness, Larry Demert Jr. He was a captain of Libby 8, another boat. He said that around 2 a.m. he woke up because he heard some noises, popping noises. So he looked out the porthole and he saw a figure. He described it as shadowy, dark, moving across the docks. But since he was just woken up from a deep sleep and it was pretty dark out, he couldn't make anything out really, just this figure. So he ended up closing this window and going back to sleep. They described that following morning as very foggy, but there were fishermen who spotted the Investor leaving the harbor at 6 a.m. Now, at this point, Justin, no one knows anything has happened, but something has happened.
Yeah, they're thinking that just them going out to start their fishing expedition.
The boat is seen to be anchored in a cove about a mile away, and that's where it stays until apparently people see a skiff going out even the next day.
Yeah.
Right? And then we get weird reports that there's a boat on fire, which of course is going to get the attention of everyone.
When the boat goes out there and they see the skiff, everyone just kind of assumes it's Mark driving. They don't really think anything of it, but that's the initial impressions people get. And they know it's been docked out on this island, and now it's been set ablaze. So it's kind of fishy, how long was this going on for before someone set it on fire?
The other thing is, this person who's controlling the skiff, they're seen by many people. And so even after the boat is seen to be on fire, there are people who see this skiff going by, and that person was asked, what's going on? And the person in the skiff said, I'm going to get help. Even the mayor of Craig, Alaska, Lee Axemaker, said, I saw the guy in the skiff. He was a cool character. He came up, talked to a few people, made a phone call, and left.
Now, it wasn't Mark in that skiff. It's somebody else.
Now, Justin, this is pretty brazen because the person in the skiff seems to be the person who set the fire, but then also said they were going to get help. But when they docked, whoever it was had told people around, hey, if you need to go to the fire, use this skiff. And they left.
Weird.
So this fire was set on September 7th, and it was found between Fish Egg and Coal Islands near Craig.
So the 5th, we know everyone on that boat was alive. They went out and celebrated. The 6th, it was docked out on this island. And the 7th, it's been set ablaze.
Now, the authorities were notified about this boat being on fire by crew members on the Casino, another fishing vessel. And people reported hearing an explosion before seeing the boat on fire.
And this is during the day. It's not in the middle of night. You know, I mean, fishermen, they get up early, you know, but this isn't at 1 a.m. when no one would have probably been around. No one probably would have seen it. This is the sun's out and this person sets this boat on fire. It's pretty brazen.
So the Coast Guard and many volunteers worked to try and put out this fire and remove bodies because there were bodies aboard this boat. The first reports were that they found two bodies with obvious bullet wounds on them. And apparently they were able to remove four bodies before the boat caught fire in a way where they had to rebattle it. It was almost like they had to start over because it just roared back to life.
And this boat, as expensive as it is, has a lot of, you know, safety measures on it. A fire on any boat's going to be a deadly situation, but they can kind of tell this was arson, being that the fire started in the living quarters, didn't start anywhere around the engine compartment, didn't start anywhere around where there would be gasoline or where there should be gasoline, started in the living quarters, and they're noticing this like white dust or white powder on everything, which indicates it was probably kerosene or some kind of high-octane gasoline, something like that.
Yeah, they think it might have been something like Coleman fuel. It's a petroleum product. And basically, this is why they're saying it was probably arson, is because it causes more intense fires. So it just seemed obvious that this wasn't, like you said, some mechanical issue or electrical issue on the boat. Now, apparently, the victims they removed from the boat were three adults and a child. But by the time they put out this fire, they've been able to find bone fragments, teeth, things like that.
It's hard for them to figure out how many bodies there are because this fire was very intense. And some of these bone fragments have been essentially mixed in with other bone fragments. So they're still trying to figure out how many bodies, how many victims. And some of them, it's just like a jawbone they found. So they have to go with dental records off of just a lower jawbone.
And of course, they will do their best to identify the remains. In the meantime, though, they did find 22 caliber bullets. So they assume that a 22 caliber gun or rifle was used to shoot at least some of the victims, because some of the victims didn't appear to have been struck by bullets. But again, it can be difficult to tell, especially with some of the remains being, you know, reduced to bones and ash.
And 22 caliber bullet is tiny, so unless it hits bone, it's really hard to determine.
So the first four bodies were identified as Mark, his wife Irene, their daughter Kimberly, and one of the crew members, Michael Stewart. But John, Jerome, Chris, and Dean were still missing. So that's where they'll have to identify the missing people via the remains that they recovered. But the main thing that the investigation is going to start off on, Justin, are these reports coming in left and right of a man that was seen on the skiff. And he was described as a white man in his early 20s, 5'10", medium build, with straight brown hair, and most notably, a pockmarked complexion. He was also seen wearing rectangular glasses and a baseball cap. But apparently, Justin, the majority of people who were out on boats at the time probably looked very similar to this.
Yeah.
20s, about 5'10", regular build.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
They don't have a lot of leads here, so they're just trying to go through who knew Mark and Irene, who were the crew members, trying to identify the remains.
It took about 2-3 months, but more of the missing people were identified. Jerome Keown, he had been working with the crew for about a week. They felt confident they had some of his remains. The other victims, they said, were burned beyond recognition, and they assumed them to be Dean Moon and Chris Heyman. Now, as far as I know, Justin, there's some question whether they were able to identify any remains belonging to John Colthurst, the young son.
But being that the son is missing, they can assume that he died on the boat.
Or he was the smallest one, so perhaps his remains were reduced further and they just didn't have any proof of him being there. But I don't know. It's one of those things that makes you wonder, if they didn't find any remains of his, could he have been taken? I guess it remains an issue where most people are confident he died in the fire.
So they don't have any obvious motives here. They don't have any obvious suspects here, because everything was pretty much destroyed in this fire.
Well, what they do start with, though, is they start interviewing all of the people who were fishing in the area at the time. There were about 150 people, they said, that needed to be interviewed, because a lot of the non-locals had already left the area before that date. So I guess that reduces the amount of people they have to talk to, but it's still a lot of interviews to be conducted. There was a time, though, Justin, where when they were trying to identify remains, they started to think that maybe one of the crew members did this and fled.
It took them a minute to kind of figure out that somebody might have done this and then come back to the boat and set it ablaze. My initial thought was it could have been a murder-suicide. Could have been one of the crew members did this and then decided to burn it all down. But it's these reports of this young guy on the skiff coming and going and then taking off that's really driving this investigation.
I had mentioned earlier that they were able to identify a couple more missing people from the remains. This was using dental records, and the two people were Chris Heyman and Jerome Keown. John Colthurst, the son, and Dean Moon were still unaccounted for. So that's how you can understand that maybe they were considering that Dean Moon might have been the one to do this. I also want to talk about this rumor that started early on about the motive being that Mark and his family were killed because he had cash on board to the tune of $33,000, right? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, they're going to try and vet that. And they found a person who came forward and said, hey, Mark asked me if he could borrow $100 to pay his bill at the restaurant because he didn't have money on him. But I can tell you, Justin, while that's nice and neat, it doesn't really explain it away for me, because all you have is a killer who believes there's money on that boat.
Yeah. And just because somebody asked to borrow money at dinner, I mean, what, he just might have forgotten his wallet, but it doesn't negate that there wasn't money on the boat. And it doesn't negate, as you said, somebody believing there's money on the boat.
Yeah. But these reports of the person seen on the skiff who was in their 20s, medium build, 5'10", right?
Yeah.
So many people came forward to talk about him. Witnesses Bruce Anderson and Jan Kittleson, they talked about the morning of the fire. They said they were on their fishing trawler. They saw flames coming out of the investor's window. So they headed that way because they wanted to help, right? This is a good, tight-knit community. When they were headed that way, they saw this gray skiff coming towards them. So Jan said she shouted out and asked the driver if there was anyone on board that boat. And the driver said there were people on the boat, but that's when he sped off towards the town. Now, she described him as a young white man with light brown hair, wearing a baseball cap and glasses. This is something that we hear again and again from these different witnesses. They describe a very similar person.
Yeah.
So there's a rescue operator in Craig named Jerry Mackey. He was at a bar when he saw this guy who looked like the skiff driver. So Mackey immediately called the state troopers. They responded and they found Bruce and Jan and brought them to the bar to make an identification, right? So if the skiff driver's there, these two have already seen him fairly close up.
Yeah, up close.
So they said, walk through the bar, and if you see the skiff driver, let us know. They walked around the whole bar and they came back and said, we don't see him here.
Yeah.
But the police, they see a guy in the bar who matches the description. So they go and talk to him.
And his name is John Peel. And he pulls out his ID, identifies himself. He says he was working on the Libby 8, which was docked next to the investor. They ask him where he was. He says, I was asleep on board that night. They ask him about Mark, and he said he knew Mark. He actually had dated Mark's sister at one point. So now we have what the police believe is somebody who matches the description and somebody who does know Mark. And it will eventually come out that he might have worked for Mark and Mark fired him. So the police are starting to hone in on John Peel because he's the only person they have that fits this description.
Yeah, he fits it so well. But the problem is Bruce and Jan, they didn't identify him.
Yeah.
They went right past him. So they don't arrest John Peel. But like you said, now they've got a name to put in their back pocket because this is not an easy case to solve. Pretty much all the evidence has burned and fallen into the water. So their next step is to go and talk to the captain of Libby 8, Larry Demert. Now, he said he's known John Peel for many years, and he said he couldn't account for Peel's whereabouts that night, even from September 5th through the 6th. In fact, he said he hadn't seen him for a couple days. But the police, they have that their gut instincts that tell them that Demert is holding back. He's not telling them everything.
So 6 months goes by. Investigators are receiving calls and tips about these murders, and they received calls that Dean Moon was seen on the fishing docks in San Francisco. So they traveled to San Francisco, but they couldn't find him.
But this happens a lot, doesn't it? Whenever you have a missing person, police will get reports that, oh, I've seen them somewhere. I've seen him here. I've seen him there. And it's just because there are people that look like the person. It doesn't mean it was necessarily them.
And then, of course, the pathologist will end up identifying a jawbone and a tooth fragment that they say probably belonged to Dean Moon. So, you know, between this partial dental identification, they think Dean Moon was one of the victims in this case, but they were never really able to find John's remains or identify John's remains.
And this is not surprising. Again, most people believe that John Coulthurst died on the boat and the boat was lost. It was very difficult to recover remains because the boat was ablaze a couple of times. So we could assume he went down with the boat.
And this is a large boat, a large fishing vessel. It's not like they have the means to keep this boat afloat and keep it going so they can pull all the evidence and lock down the crime scene. It's not that easy.
Another thing that investigators have to do is try to put themselves in the mindset of the killer. So their belief is because this killer drove this boat out and was able to handle it just fine, they believe that they had a lot of experience with boats and probably knew Mark. And because they knew a lot about the fishing industry, they assume, they probably knew that Mark didn't have any cash on him. So now they start to wonder, if this wasn't about money, and this person didn't steal the boat or anything, then what was it about? And motive is a big thing in this case, Justin. A big question. So they start looking at crew members on the boat and wondering if they had some connection somewhere that could explain what happened here.
Rumors are flying around that Mark had used the boat to smuggle drugs. Rumors are abound that he had fired or treated a lot of his crew members poorly. So disgruntled employee possibly came back and did this. There's lots of things the police are having to try to vet.
There was a former cook for the investor who had left town the week before. And when he was questioned, he said there was never any indication that anybody on that boat made enemies or that anybody was resentful. It was the kind of boat that inspired a little envy, but what could be gained by killing all the people and burning it up?
Yeah, if you had a problem with Mark, the captain of the boat, then you would target him, not him, his wife, his children, and all the crew members.
Well, let's talk about that, Justin. What if that is what happened? What if someone targeted Mark and didn't necessarily want to target anyone else on the boat? By firing that gun, wouldn't they have woken other people up, possibly?
You know, if you don't want to leave any witnesses, then I guess that makes sense. But targeting Mark on a boat full of people just doesn't seem like a very smart idea.
Well, the trouble is, maybe they didn't have any other way to do this, right? Other than creep onto the boat in the middle of the night, because maybe Mark, at least according to reports, he was always around his family.
And so now with this belief that John Peel is an ex-disgruntled employee of Mark's, well, he's the only suspect they have.
So the detective sergeant in charge was Charles Miller, and he had a task force of state troopers. And they did an extensive investigation, a lot of which was interviews, looking into possible connections. Could anybody on the boat have made an enemy? Could someone have targeted them? And then, of course, like you said, no witnesses. That could explain why everyone was killed. Also, the fact that maybe, just maybe, Mark and Irene were shot and no one else was. That's another idea here, is that maybe someone killed the couple and then set fire to the boat, which quickly killed everyone else.
Possibility.
But this detective, Miller, he didn't believe this theory that was floated, that the killer could have somehow murdered the wrong crew, right? Because the investor, that's the kind of boat everyone can recognize. As he puts it, the investor stood out like a man in a white suit among the aging vessels around her. Now, they also don't believe this theory that was floated, that the murders were a warning from Alaskan fishermen to Washington fishermen to stay out of their area.
Yeah.
And the detective said, realistically, there's always been some hard feelings among the Alaskan fishermen towards out-of-state people, but this would have been pretty bloody extreme. I sincerely believe it was an isolated incident and won't happen again.
Yeah. It just all goes back to, they really think this is somebody that had a tie, some sort of connection to Mark or someone on that boat.
I had said earlier that the police were skeptical about Larry Demart Jr.'s comments, his statements, because they felt like he was holding back. Mm-hmm. So in September of 1983, they interview him a second time. And this time, well, Larry tells a story, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He says that he was walking back to the boat at 10 p.m. on September 5th because he had been hanging out with his girlfriend. And he said he saw people on board the Investor. He also saw John Peel cross over from the Libby 8 to the Investor.
Yeah.
He said John did not sleep on the Libby 8 that night. And before, he said, I don't know where he was. Now he's saying he was definitely not on the Libby 8. He said that he himself, Demart, was the only one on board the Libby 8 that night. And he said, normally, there were two guns on the boat. One was a .22 revolver, one a .22 rifle. And he said, on the night of the murders, they were both gone. They were missing. Now, he said he found them in the wheelhouse when he was getting ready to put the boat away for the season.
Mm.
So he found them later. Now, luckily for the investigators, Demart turned his weapons in for testing, right? He's cooperating.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to hear from other crew members from the Libby 8. They talk with Brian Palinkas. He came forward with more information, and he said that John Peel, here's that name again, brought Investor crew onto the Libby 8, and he said Peel had sold marijuana to Jerome and Dean on the 5th of September, just before the murders.
And that's the reason why Mark fired him, was because Mark didn't want any drugs or alcohol on his boat.
Now the investigators want to go back to John Peel, and they say, how come you didn't tell us about selling Jerome and Dean marijuana? And he opened up about having worked for Mark for about 2 years, but Mark fired him in 1981. And like you said, he knew Mark didn't want any drugs or alcohol there while men were working. And that's why John Peel was fired and was barred from ever stepping onto that boat again. So it feels like John's talking a bit, but they're not really learning a lot. Meanwhile, they did some testing on those guns. What did they find?
Well, none of the ballistics were conclusive to point to anything. So it's kind of useless.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if they could have had another agency test these guns. I'm not trying to say that Miller and his crew were inept or anything, but we've seen this in other cases where sometimes there are certain things that departments just aren't good at. And this is where maybe an outside agency could have done the testing, possibly. But I don't know. I would have liked to have seen a second opinion here.
So at this point, they don't have a murder weapon, and they can't tie any of these bullets back to a murder weapon. So that's going to be really hard later to try to identify somebody as the murderer and in possession of the murder weapon.
So investigators, they're stymied here. They go ahead and publish a sketch of the skiff driver as described by witnesses. And this brings someone forward to report seeing the skiff parked at the docks on the day of the murders. And this person identified John Peel from a photo lineup as the skiff driver.
But at this point, this is the biggest story, especially in this town, much less in the whole state of Alaska, and it's getting bigger and bigger because it's a mass murder. You have a whole family that's been wiped out and a crew of a ship. So people are paying attention.
September 10th, 1984, John Kenneth Peel, 24 years old, was arrested and charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of first-degree arson. They set his bail at $1 million.
Yeah. I mean, if you're accused of murdering all these people, including children, I'm surprised they even gave him bail, honestly.
Now, the police were asked, what was the motive here? Now, obviously, you've arrested someone that you believe did it. What was their motive? And Sergeant James Stogsdill replied, we think the motive was something spontaneous. We've ruled out robbery or drugs. What do you make of that, Justin? Because spontaneous? I mean, did they get into an argument and he got mad and went back?
Yeah, they got into an argument, and if John is the murderer here, John got mad and attacked Mark and ended up killing him. And then maybe went on to kill everyone else because he didn't want to leave any witnesses, or they tried to stop him and it just got out of control.
In August of 1984, a coroner's jury was convened. It was known as a presumptive death hearing, and it ruled that all eight people aboard the Investor were killed, and that at least Mark and Irene were shot in the head. Now, John Peel had been working as an assembly line boat builder at Murray Chris in Bellingham, Washington, since July 1984, and they arrested him on his way to work. So what do they have on this guy? I mean, they don't have a weapon that they can tie to him. They don't have a weapon at all. All they have is, I guess, statements by people from the Libby 8 who basically said Peel must have done it because they saw him boarding the boat and these weapons were missing, but they couldn't tie those weapons to this crime.
And then they have the witnesses that saw somebody that looked like him on a skiff. And then you have the witness that identifies him from the sketches and information they're putting out there.
So they say in all, they have four witnesses who say John Peel was the man they saw driving the skiff. Tell you what, Justin, in these days where true crime is happening on TV, on podcasts, and it's in books, and everybody's talking about it, this doesn't float very well, does it? Pardon the pun. I mean, to just have four people saying, that's the guy, is that enough? And they made an arrest here and charged him.
They feel like they've tied enough to him. He knew Mark. Mark had fired him, and he was in proximity of Mark the night of. And if the murderer had done this on the night of the 5th or during the 6th, and then you have people seeing John Peel possibly on a skiff coming and going from this boat that's about a mile out, well, obviously, if he's the one on the skiff, then he's the one that's done this. They connect the dots pretty easily here.
Many of John Peel's friends or associates are interviewed as part of the investigation, and they are all unanimous, it seems, in describing him as a guy who avoided fights and was very good-natured.
They're saying he's a good guy, and he was very generous and very kind to others, and they're not thinking that this is somebody that would be capable of murder, and he had no record, no criminal history. He just smoked pot.
One of the things they learned, though, was that John Peel did want to work for Mark Colthurst again. And apparently, according to one fisherman, it was because the Libby 8 was this old boat, right? Kind of a rough boat. And in comparison, the Investor was a Cadillac. What do we know about John Kenneth Peel?
Well, he was married. He had one kid. He lived in Bellingham during this investigation. And again, it's just, he doesn't have a criminal record. Nobody that knows him thinks that he fits this profile.
But they're definitely trying to build this case against him. And the district attorney in Ketchikan, Marianne Henry, said on September 10th, 1984, that the authorities had four people who were witnesses identifying John Peel as the man leaving the boat in the skiff. And they also had six witnesses who said that John Peel purchased two 2.5-gallon jugs of gasoline on September 7th, the very day of the fire.
Yeah. That's a lot of people saying that he is somehow involved. He was seen around this boat driving the skiff, and the boat was set on fire, and somebody had to buy the gasoline to do that. So here we are.
John Peel has to make an appearance in court, Justin, but he handles this occasion a little differently than most.
Yeah, he wears a mask to court. He gets approval to do this. So sometimes he's wearing like a ski mask. Other times he's wearing like Halloween masks, but he doesn't want his face shown to the public. He didn't want the courtroom sketch artist drawing any pictures of him. If there was any photographers or media outside the courthouse, you know, when he was coming and going, he didn't want his face out there at all.
He also wore a bulletproof vest because he was worried about his safety. And his defense attorney was Philip Widener. They say this was a very flamboyant defense attorney. He liked the theatrics, and he really liked to connect with the juries that he dealt with.
And so he's going to face a grand jury, and he will be indicted on all 9 counts, 8 first-degree murder charges, 1 first-degree arson charge. There were 25 witnesses that testified at this 2-day hearing, all of which, of course, are talking about how they saw John in some capacity being involved with this crime.
Or in the area. So, I mean, it does sound significant, right? You have 25 witnesses who are on the prosecution side here. But again, they don't have forensic evidence that ties John Kenneth Peel to these murders. So John Peel was extradited to Alaska on November 8th, 1984. Like you said, he's wearing masks. The defense had requested these precautions. They didn't want him photographed during transport, and officers were not allowed to talk to him. The next day, though, Peel's attorney said that they would show that state prosecutors intimidated witnesses at the grand jury hearing. It's kind of significant, Justin, at least for me, because I think about this case, I think about all the cases we've covered, and you just don't hear about someone wearing disguises or masks. And during this grand jury hearing, Peel was wearing a fake mustache, a woman's wig, and mirrored sunglasses. And he did not speak, right? He didn't enter a plea.
The defense is bringing this evidence to the judge saying the DA is intimidating witnesses, and we need to throw this whole case out, you know, dismiss this indictment, because there is just too many problems right off the bat for us to move forward. But of course, the judge is saying, well, you know, you're saying that the DA is doing this, and the DA is saying, well, they're doing bad things too. And I guess the judge is kind of like to two children, well, he hit you first, you hit back. We're just moving on from here, and you two need to get along.
Well, the defense, though, they're not going to stop, because that's their main attack here, is to say that this prosecutor, this DA, has manipulated the grand jury into getting this indictment against John Kenneth Peel. They don't want him in court again for these crimes. And they submitted 25 pages worth of irregularities that allegedly occurred, right, during this indictment. And they claimed that the witnesses were coerced into changing their testimony, probably to fit the theory here and fit the evidence that they have.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So August 30th, 1985, a Superior Court judge dismissed the murder indictments against John Peel, and the indictment was dismissed without prejudice. Now, this is not what his attorneys had asked for. They wanted the indictment dismissed with prejudice, but since it was done without prejudice, prosecutors could reindict him again. But the judge does determine that the prosecutors misled the grand jury. Let's talk about this. The prosecution, they presented a witness who testified that he saw John Peel purchase gasoline in Craig on September 7th, but the prosecution did not tell the grand jury that only residues of white gas were found on the hull of the investor, meaning regular gasoline, that doesn't appear to have been used in the arson.
The gasoline as an accelerant won't leave this white residue, and that's the whole point is, we know this was arson because of this white residue, which would have been left by these other items, but not by gasoline. So by saying this guy saw John Peel purchasing gasoline that morning is actually inconsequential to the fire on this boat.
So other motions were not accepted, right? The judge said no to those and also refused to get rid of the $1 million bail. But he had neighbors and friends that started raising money to help him make bond. John Peel, though, was reindicted on October 4th, 1985.
Because, as we know, the indictment, a grand jury indictment, is one of the easiest things for a prosecutor to get by. So the fact that the first one got thrown out and they're having to redo it is kind of telling that this is a mess.
January 20th, 1986, John Peel goes to trial.
Now, the prosecution, they're going to take the stance that John had a grudge against Mark, you know, because of his termination as a crew member. And he went into a drunken rage, shot Mark, Irene, the kids, and the crew, and then, of course, set the boat on fire. Now, John Peel, he has Brant McGee as an attorney. He has a whole lineup of attorneys, but Brant McGee took this case for free or pro bono because he believed in John's innocence that strongly.
Now, the defense, they go with this: John Peel was sleeping at the time and then ran errands in town when the boat was being set on fire. They also suggested that Mark Colthurst was selling cocaine to pay off his boat and that his death and the deaths of his family and crew members were because a gang possibly wanted them killed because of drugs or money. There was some connection there with drugs or money, which is interesting because Mark had apparently terminated John Peel as a crew member over drugs.
Yeah. It's kind of a contradiction there, right?
Yeah. And one of John's attorneys, Philip Widener, was trying to say that Dean Moon might have been the killer.
Although it's possible that Dean Moon was one of the victims based on a partial identification from his jawbone.
August 28, 1986, this trial ends in a mistrial.
The jury just was like, there is too many problems here. And as much as we might feel John looks guilty and has odd behavior, the prosecution's having a really hard time painting a picture out, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they can't come to a conclusion and the judge dismisses them.
So this judge, Thomas Schultz, scheduled another trial for January 20th, 1987, but it actually doesn't start until January 15th, 1988. And the district attorney, Mary Henry, she says they've got two new witnesses, Charles and Walter Samuelson Jr., who talked to them about John Peel. This is what they said. They said a year after the murders, John Peel came back to Alaska for work, and he was on a fishing boat with these two men and confessed to them as being the one who killed this family and the crew. So Charles Samuelson, he came forward in December of 87. He wanted to offer his testimony in exchange for dismissal of several misdemeanors that he had. So the state said, okay, we're on board. They dropped an assault charge and two counts of furnishing alcohol to a minor. Now, the other thing that Mary Henry does is she said, we definitely made some errors investigating this case. She said, we didn't have a strong enough motive and we didn't have real physical evidence. But she said, based on the witness testimony, they could prove it was Peel who left on the skiff the morning of the fire. So she's trying to say, we don't have a lot here, but we have enough.
Painting the timeline, they're saying that you have the two skippers that heard the gunshots, a woman screaming before the investor was found, burning in the water. They have several people who give a somewhat vague description of a white man on the investor and someone leaving on the skiff. So here we have the prosecution doing their best to say, we have people that put John Peel at the scene. We have people that put him on that skiff. Whoever's driving that skiff is the perpetrator of this crime. Therefore, it's John Peel. Therefore, you need to find him guilty.
So the second trial, it's really hinging on these witnesses. will the jury be swayed by what they say? Because as the DA says, Mary Henry, they don't have a real motive here. They don't have anything where they can say, this is definitely why these people were murdered. And they also don't have the murder weapon.
And so the defense, they're coming in and they're cross-examining these witnesses and they're asking them, like, why did it take you so long to come forward? Oh, you're getting other charges dropped and now you're identifying our client as the person on that skiff, or the Libby captain the night of, I don't know where John Peel was. And then his statement changes to, oh, I saw John Peel going to the investor boat the night of. And the defense doesn't even call their own witnesses to the stand. They simply point out all the inconsistencies of the witness testimony that's being put up by the prosecution.
And of course, we know now that eyewitness testimony can be very unreliable. Or at what point do people start seeing John Peel as the person who was the skiff driver, but maybe he wasn't, right? I mean, it could have just taken over in their mind. We don't know how influential detectives were on this case with their witnesses. After all, the defense is trying to maintain that these witnesses were manipulated. I think this is what they're getting at. I'm not saying it's what happened, but I'm saying it's a possibility.
The defense merely points out that they have no physical evidence tying John Peel to this crime scene. And they even question the crime scene itself because they're saying the crime scene's sank to the bottom. You know, it was set on fire and it sank. So there's no further testing that can be done. We can't investigate this. All we have are these witnesses that claim he was around there. You can't tie any physical evidence to our client.
It was sunk, yeah. Right? And yeah. So that's kind of what happened with this case, Justin. Mm-hmm. Not only did this boat sink, but the case, well, it sank too. On April 23rd, 1988, John Kenneth Peel was acquitted of all charges. What did he say outside the courthouse?
He said, "It's terrible being an innocent man accused of a crime. I just thank God it's over. Justice did work this time." And this case at the time was huge. It went national news. It wasn't just this tiny murder case no one heard about in Craig, Alaska. This was national news. People were following it. And of course, when you have a whole family wiped out, including children, emotions are running high. And people think that John Peel should have been found guilty. They felt like he was the prime suspect in this case. I guess that's why you would understand, or anyone should understand, why he was hiding his face this whole time, because he was being called the murderer in the media before the trial even started.
Well, there's that eagerness to solve the case, right? Mm-hmm. And if the police have focused on a suspect or a person of interest, it can be very, very easy to say, well, that must be the killer. Because why would the police bring, why would they arrest someone? And why would the DA want to charge them with murders if they didn't commit the murders? But as we know how this case ended, well, now you have to start all over again. Because at least according to this jury, John Peel was not the killer. But that's not how law enforcement sees it, right?
Yeah. Well, they, you know, he's been acquitted. So you would think, well, somebody committed this crime. We know it was foul play. So what other suspects do we have? What other leads do we have? But law enforcement says, well, we had our guy. It was the jury's fault that justice wasn't served.
Yeah.
And even the DA says the jury is the reason why a guilty man walked free.
Now, that is possible, right? It's possible that John Kenneth Peel was the killer in this case, and the prosecution just failed to prove it, or at least convince a jury. But I don't know. When you look at this case, Justin, they relied, I guess, solely on witness testimony. And it is very suspicious to me that the captain of the Libby 8 would first say, yeah, I don't know where John was. I don't know what was going on. And then when they interviewed him much later, he suddenly offered up that he saw John Peel go on board the investor. That's kind of convenient.
And then when there's the allegations of witness manipulation, witness intimidation by the DA, and then during the second trial, which, you know, again, this is one indictment thrown out, a second indictment for the first trial that was a hung jury, and then a second trial, the DA has witnesses now that they're bringing forward that are getting their charges dropped or lessened to give this testimony. I'm surprised that they even brought charges against John Peel with the amount of evidence or lack thereof, because I don't know, like, how do you get a guilty verdict with this besides if you really were able to place him there? But this is, you know, the early 80s. Like, he didn't have a phone on him. There's no way to track where he was. And some of the witnesses that aren't able to point him out, but because he appears to match the description, the cops are the ones that go after him, not the witnesses that allegedly saw him on that skiff or around the investor the day of. And honestly, Aaron, like, when I heard about him wearing a mask in the courtroom, at first I thought, oh, this is ridiculous, and what a moron for wearing a mask. But then the more I thought about it, I thought, would a guilty person wear a mask in court to protect their identity? I mean, if you had done it, there is always that possibility that you're going to be found guilty and you're going to prison for the rest of your life. But if you're innocent and you know that you've already been painted as guilty, and you're trying to do what you can to hide yourself from the public, this doesn't make me believe he's guilty or not guilty, but I think only an innocent person would wear a mask in court. I don't think a guilty person would probably do that, because the logic doesn't play out for me. He thinks, I didn't do this, and I don't want the rest of the world or the public to think I did it either, so they're not going to see who I am.
So just those in Craig would probably know who he was, but
yeah,
many of the people outside of there would have no idea what he looked like.
Yeah. And I'm not basing my opinion of his guilt or innocence off the fact that he wore a mask in court, but I just think that actually is more indicative of somebody that's trying to protect themselves that didn't do anything wrong. And I understand why he did it. And it was a smart move by him and his, you know, lawyers to come up with that, because yeah, if he hadn't of, I mean, now we can all Google him and find out what he looks like, but at the time that wasn't available. So he definitely was trying to protect himself, because I think in his mind, I didn't do this, I'm going to be found not guilty, and I have to live the rest of my life without looking over my shoulder thinking someone's going to come after me because they believe I'm a mass murderer who kills children. John Peel would end up suing the state for wrongful prosecution. You know, we always hear wrongful conviction, but he said this was completely unfounded and it cost me, because he and his family had to put their house up for collateral to pay the lawyer fees. I mean, I know the one guy took it pro bono, but he had to pay a lot of lawyers. He had a lot of costs here. So he sues for wrongful prosecution, and he will end up receiving a $900,000 settlement.
Well, if anyone would like to see images of people involved in this case, even pictures of John Peel, they can go to People Magazine Investigates. They've covered this. Another good source of information I would recommend is What Happened in Craig. It's Alaska's Worst Unsolved Mass Murder by Leland Hale. This book is a very well-written book, I would say. I think it's interesting because Hale points out in the book that the police had a very difficult time with this investigation because a lot of the witnesses, let's just say they used alcohol and drugs often, and even people who could have come forward but didn't, well, they were worried about getting in trouble being seen as a snitch. So this is a difficult investigation from the start, and at no point did it get any easier. And I think the jury did what it was supposed to do. There wasn't enough proof that the killer was on trial there in either trial.
Never miss an episode of Generation Y. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. After subscribing, please leave us a review. Our website is genypod.com. Visit to learn more about events and updates. Justin and I have other podcasts. Mine is Framed, an Investigative Story. Each season is a deep dive into a case that went wrong and why. Justin's other podcast is The Peripheral. His podcast is a safe space for listeners and their stories.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.